Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments in Holt Atchison Industries, Inc. v. Hine. From petitioners, we're ready to hear arguments.
May it please the Court, Mr. G. Wayne Caldwell presents argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, my name is Wade Caldwell, and I represent four of the six defendants that the Hineys have sued in this case on the identical claim. I represent the petitioner in this case, Holt Atchison Industries, and at the trial court level, we represented Mr. Holt, who was sued individually, B.D. Holt Company, and Holt Machinery Company. This case is an appeal of a default judgment of over $160,000 against the petitioner, and we're before the Court on several points. I will address three of the points and leave the rest to the brief. The first point we'll address is whether our motion for new trial met the standards of Craddock v. Sunshine Bus. The second point will be whether the Hineys' generic pleadings in this case were sufficient under Stoner v. Thompson. And the third point will be whether a defendant who comes into court alleging that he's the improper defendant or the wrong defendant for all of the claims of the plaintiff has to show all three elements of Craddock v. Sunshine Bus. And of the remaining points that are being left to the brief, I would especially invite the Court to look at the lost profit issue, although the writ was not granted on that point. Of course, the Court has jurisdiction to look at that issue. And the default judgment evidence was absolutely legally insufficient on the lost profits issue. Your Honors, this is essentially a DTPA case involving an alleged breach of an oral warranty over a transmission repair on a dozer, and a second claim involving some alleged oral misrepresentations associated with the sale of a cable unit to the Hineys. The Hineys have sued six different people, and there are five particular points I would point the Court to in the original record that merit looking at. The first is when this case was originally filed, it was filed against Mr. Holt individually. And it's significant to look at the caption of the case because it was filed against Mr. B.D. Holt individually, DBA, B.D. Holt Company, DBA Holt Company of Texas, which shows initially the Hineys knew there was an entity out there named B.D. Holt Company that they were trying to name but had mistakenly named it as a DBA instead of a corporation. The second point in the original record is to look at Mr. Holt's answer. When he answered, he stated, and I'll read from it, defendant specifically and specially denies that he is liable in the capacity in which he has been sued. B.D. Holt Company, Inc. is a Texas corporation and has been since 1961. Holt Company of Texas is an assumed name of B.D. Holt Company, Inc. Defendant does further allege that there is a defect of parties as he has never had any dealings with the plaintiffs. So right then, the Hineys were put on notice through the answer that B.D. Holt Company, first, was a corporation, and second, that Mr. Holt was telling them that that was the proper defendant for the case. The third major point to look at in the record, the original record, was the Second Amendment petition, which was filed on June 11, 1988, named four defendants, Mr. Holt again, plus three corporations. And to look at that Second Amendment petition carefully, because there is absolutely no explanation in that petition how four different defendants could have somehow be liable for selling a cable unit or repairing a dozer. There's no allegation of any joint and several liability between the defendants. There's no allegation that the defendants were agents for each other. There is a paragraph that states that individuals are agents for the defendants, but it doesn't state that the defendants are agents of each other. There's no allegations of any alternative liability theory or any conspiracy between the defendants. It's very plainly a single claim against one of four defendants that the Hineys did not claim to know which one was the right one. And in fact, the supplemental record shows that Mr. Griffin's brother, what actually happened was that he was panicking over the statute of limitations deadline, that he called the Secretary of State and got the name of every company he could find that had the name Holt in it and sued them all. And that's how that happened. The fourth major point to look at in the original record is the default judgment itself, because the default judgment at the end states that all relief which has been requested that is not granted in the default judgment has been denied. So the default judgment is itself a complete adjudication of the Heine's claim, and it's a claim against a single defendant. And the fifth point to look at in the original record is the fact that even after the Heine's took this default judgment, and as they now concede in their most recent brief, probably bars any further claim against BD Holt Company if this default judgment is upheld, they certainly were cognizant of the fact they'd probably taken the judgment against the wrong company, because they amended again after the default judgment to add BD Holt Company finally and Holt Machinery Company. Now, the supplemental record details the history of the merger. The chart here details some of the chronological events. Basically, Holt Atherton Industries was a holding company for Holt Machinery Company and was merged out of existence into the surviving corporation, which was BD Holt Company, before this suit was ever filed by the Heine's.
Could you tell me, please, I'm a little confused about dates. Did the discovery in the trial court end in 88 or 89?
The discovery in the trial court ended in 1989.
You have it both ways in your brief. And the request to the trial court to set aside the default judgment was in January of 89 or 90?
It was filed in October of 89 and heard in January of 90.
And the move, the motion to amend your brief, that was in 90 also and not 89?
Yes, Your Honor. That brings us to the first point, which is, was the motion for a new trial sufficient under credit? Since 1858, in this court's opinion, a mistaken legal belief has been held to be sufficient to meet the first step of credit, which is showing a lack of conscious indifference. And in fact, the brief cites at least eight other opinions, including courts of appeals opinions, that have held that a mistaken legal belief as to the necessity for filing an answer is sufficient to show lack of conscious indifference. So the issue and what the Heine's have tried to argue in this case is to try to get the court to focus solely on Mr. Atherton's affidavit when there are other facts in the record which should have been considered by the trial court and should have resulted in the motion for new trial being granted in the first place. In addition to Mr. Atherton's affidavit, which states, number one, that Holt Atherton never dealt with the Heine's, and number two, that it's not even in this business. There was also a verified motion filed along with it that stated that Holt Atherton was no longer actively operating. There was also the initial suit filed against Mr. Holt where he pointed out that BD Holt Company was the proper defendant and that it was a Texas corporation. So all of these facts were before the trial judge and should have been considered. The question then is, if Mr. Atherton is served with a suit, the company has never dealt with the Heine's, it's no longer actively operating, it is not even in the business of selling equipment or repairing dozers, is that sufficient to show a mistaken legal belief? And certainly, it falls far short of showing conscious indifference, the standard under Craddock. And the cases we've cited show, I think, far less in terms of a reason for finding no conscious indifference than what was shown in Mr. Atherton's affidavit in this case. The second point, let me quickly address the other two elements of Craddock, I think, were clearly shown. First of all, we showed a meritorious defense. Mr. Atherton's affidavit states, we didn't deal with you. And second, we're not in that business, which I think certainly is a meritorious defense. Third, the motion offered to reimburse the plaintiffs for their expenses, and under Cliff versus Huggins, that shifts the burden to the plaintiff to show somehow they were prejudiced. Also, the record shows that this case was not set for trial at the time the default judgment was taken, so there was no delay. And we would submit to the court that the original motion for new trial, which would be the simplest issue for this court to rule on, was sufficient to meet Craddock versus Sunshine Bus. The second point would be that the second amended petition, this generic petition which was filed against four defendants, falls under Stoner versus Thompson. Stoner versus Thompson cautions that the theory of liability should be shown from examination of the plaintiff's pleadings alone. and also that if the petition affirmatively shows the invalidity of a claim, that the pleadings cannot support the default judgment. The petition in this case is very peculiar for the reasons I've mentioned. It doesn't explain anything about how four different defendants could have sold the same piece of equipment, how four different defendants could have repaired the same transmission. In fact, throughout the body of the pleading, it only uses the name Holt Atherton when it talks about where to serve. Throughout the body of the petition, it uses the word defendants, and in some cases even drops the S and just says defendant without specifying which of the four defendants they're suing. It also, again, doesn't allege conspiracy, doesn't allege joint several liability, it doesn't allege agency between the defendants. Clearly, this particular petition falls under Stoner because when you read the petition, it's clear that they first don't know who they're suing and they don't know which of these four defendants is liable. And we would submit to the court that this falls under Stoner versus Thompson and that the petition in this case was insufficient. The third point is whether, when a defendant comes into court, they have to show all three elements of Craddock versus Sunshine Bus when they're coming in and saying, we're the wrong defendant, we're not the right defendant for any of your claims. We submit that this case also falls under McKenna versus Edgar from this court, where the court talks about direct attacks on default judgments. The two primary lines of cases have involved cases where service was improper or there was no jurisdiction. And in those cases, you don't have to show all three elements of Craddock, you just have to show those facts. We submit that also, if the defendant comes in and says, we are not the right defendant for any of these claims, that also falls under McKenna versus Edgar. And the reason being that Craddock, I think, assumes that the person is coming into court saying, well, we may be the proper defendant, but we have a meritorious defense, we have a reason why we didn't answer, and we're willing to either reimburse your expenses, and there's been no undue delay. And we would request that the court also follow McKenna and reverse the default judgment. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, is Cynthia Shepherd and Mr. John Griffin present argument for respondent. Ms. Shepherd will open.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I will be arguing the issues, the first two points, those of supplementation and liability established by not answering, and Mr. Griffin will address the issue of the Craddock point. However, before I get into the merits of the case, I would like to urge to the court our motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. None of the points that are being considered by the court today were raised by the petitioner in its motion for rehearing. One of the points is not mentioned anywhere. In fact, it was not even raised to the Court of Appeals on original submission. The other two points are supposedly raised in a brief in support of the motion for rehearing, but that is insufficient under this court's ruling in Oilfield Haulers Association case that is cited in my brief. In that case, this court has said you cannot incorporate by reference points of error to rely on in a motion for rehearing. That does not comply with the rule, and it does not invoke the jurisdiction of its court. So we would ask that this writ be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction on all three of these points. With that reservation, I will go ahead and discuss the first point of error, which is the supplementation issue. As you're aware, the petitioners attempted to supplement this record at the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals denied that motion. Your Honors, the important thing for the court to understand is that the 500-some-odd pages that were tendered to the Court of Appeals, none of those documents were ever before the trial court in this case. At no time, not at the time of the judgment, not at the time the court overruled their motion for new trial, or any time within its plenary power. The bulk of these documents consist of pleadings and depositions taken in an entirely separate case that were never filed in this case.
Severed from this case.
That case was severed from this case.
Well, they started out the same, but they ended up different.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that severance made those two cases two separate, distinctly separate cases. That
same cause of action, same plaintiffs, but this defendant was severed out.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that severance was never complained of by the petitioner even up to today. Therefore, any complaint of that severance has been waived. The remaining document, some 24 pages, consists of a motion for reconsideration and the original answer filed by this petitioner. And those documents were filed in this case, but they were filed a full year after the trial court had lost any plenary power in this case. The court had no jurisdiction to even consider those pleadings. They were never before the trial court, and they should not have been allowed to supplement this record. And I've delineated those dates in my brief on page 7 to show that those documents were filed in October of 1989. This judgment became final on September 26, 1988, when this case was severed out from the other cause.
What is the status of the other case?
It's been abated, Your Honor, pending this disposition of this appeal. The petitioner was thereby trying to make a direct attack on this default judgment with collateral evidence and open up that default judgment to new facts never considered by the trial court. In other words, to make the Court of Appeals a trial court and to make findings a fact. Also, the Court of Appeals ruling and denying that motion could be sustained simply upon the fact that it would have unreasonably delayed disposition of the appeal. It was filed 2 weeks before submission of the case when the case had been on appeal for a full year.
Exactly correct in every legal point you've made in your brief and you've made in your oral argument, but did this strike you as something very unseemly to get a judgment against a entity that had nothing to do with repairs, the Caterpillar, question here?
No, Your Honor, it does not. And I'll tell you why. For one thing, there is no evidence in this record that this is the wrong defendant.
There's no evidence that it's wrong?
There's absolutely no evidence in this record that this is the wrong defendant. The only evidence in this record is Mr. Stevenson Etherton's affidavit where he says, we did not deal directly with the Heine. They could be liable under an agency theory, and they could be liable under the Texas Business Corporation Act as the successor or predecessor corporation.
Plead an agency theory?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. We pled it, and we also pled that each defendant was liable for the acts of the others under an agency theory.
Did that include the insurance company and the radio station which is sued by accident?
Your Honor, those were non-suited. As soon as those attorneys called us and said, we have nothing to do with this case. The fact...
Why didn't you go ahead and take the fault against them?
Because they told us they were the wrong defendant.
Why did you believe them and not this?
Because it's not true that they're not the wrong defendant, Your Honor. They are liable for these
acts. Under your theory, you could have taken the fault judgment against the insurance company and the radio station if they hadn't answered.
Well, ethically, I would have a question of that. If I knew they were represented, I would have to tell them I was taking a default judgment against them. But
if they didn't answer, could.
Certainly, we could have.
And there wouldn't be anything they could do about it?
Oh, sure there would be. They had a perfect right to come in on their motion for new trial and show they were the wrong defendant, to show they had a meritorious defense, to show that it was not due to conscious indifference for why they did not answer, and to show that it would not injure or delay the plaintiff. And
but
here,
if they came in on their motion for new trial and said, we didn't answer in this case because we're an insurance company and a radio station and we didn't think we were involved, they wouldn't be entitled to a new trial on the theory. That would be an intentional decision on their part.
If they said that they did not answer because they didn't think they were liable, I think that is conscious indifference. if they said that they didn't feel that an answer was necessary due to some mistaken legal beliefs, and I think there's authority that that would meet the prong of credit, but that simply is not the case here. And I think that's evidence.
How is that different to saying we don't think we're liable because we're in the insurance business and we don't do this kind of work? How is that, how is it conscious indifference to say we're not liable and to say we're not liable because we're not in that business?
Well, I didn't mean to concede that if I just said we didn't have anything to do with this, we're not liable, so we didn't file an answer. I think that is conscious indifference. If they had a justifiable reason, and they had shown some diligence to determine whether they had were under a mistaken legal belief, I think that would not be conscious indifference. But it was their burden to would be their burden to show that.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you first about Craddock, and this is in the last paragraph. It says the default judgment should be set aside when the granting will cause no occasion of delay or otherwise work in injury to the plaintiff. This is a just rule. It prevents injustice to the defendant without working in injustice to the plaintiff. And Rule 1 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure said the objective of these rules is just, fair, equitable, and impartial adjudication of the rights of the parties. How would setting aside a default judgment work and injustice on the plaintiff?
Your Honor, I think the question is here whether it would be an injustice to the defendant to enforce this judgment. And it would not be an injustice because I can tell you on the trial and the merits in this case, this defendant would be liable.
Counsel, you changed the question. Would you answer the question? Why would it be an injustice to the plaintiff?
Well, because under Craddock, that's only one prong and you have to meet the three prongs, and I believe that's based on a balance of the interests of plaintiffs in obtaining a final judgment, and that would be the injustice to the plaintiff here. But the burden isn't on us to show that, it's on the defendant to show how it would be an injustice to them. And in this case, even if you assume these facts of the merger and that this was not an existing corporation at the time of the service of the citation, they would still be liable. Under the Texas Business Corporation Act, when you merge with another corporation, you assume all those liabilities. Holt Atherton Industries, Inc. merged with the company that the Heinies dealt with. They thereby assumed all the liabilities of Holt Machinery.
Did you plead that?
No, we did not. But under the case law, we don't have to plead that. It would be objectionable under a special exception. But Stoner v. Thompson itself says, even though it may be objectionable under special exception, that does not provide grounds for setting aside a default judgment. What provides the grounds for setting aside a default judgment is, it's void because there was no service, which is not the case here, and there's no allegation that's true. You can tell that the court had no jurisdiction to enter that judgment, which is not true here. Or that the pleadings are insufficient because they do not state a cause of action. And clearly here, our petition states a cause of action, and there's no allegation that we don't.
Counsel, your time's about to expire. I think your co-counsel is chomping at the bit to argue.
Okay, well, I'll turn my argument over to him to argue the Craddock issue.
May it please the court, John Griffin from Victoria. This case is really whether or not we're going to engraft an exception to Craddock. And when we start talking about exceptions, it brings to mind the old axiom, which has been quoted by some of the judges, that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. In this particular case, the petitioner is asking this court to engraft an exception to say that if we're the wrong defendant, then we should not have to meet the other prongs of Craddock. Our position is that they ought to be able to show some public policy why Craddock has not worked for 60 years and that wrong defendants have been able to get new trials when wrong defendants have been sued. We have a policy in this state that has served us now for 60 years, and we suggest that the petitioner ought to state why even a wrong party, if we even concede that, should not have to come into court and point that out to the trial court. Our bench and bar now have been served by these principles of predictability with Craddock.
But it won't meet your test if the defendant does. If the radio station comes in and says, we're a radio station, we have nothing to do with this case, so we decided not to file an answer, under your view of Craddock, they were not entitled to a new trial.
Absolutely right under our view of Craddock for this reason. We don't allow defendants, when they are sued, to make a decision at that point and say we're the wrong defendant. Because no defendant in Texas is going to agree when they're sued that I'm the right guy and this is what I did wrong. We leave that for the courts. And furthermore, all this trial court had before it when it reviewed this motion for new trial was that affidavit. The affidavit says I didn't know anything about the facts of this case. Doesn't say it wasn't in business. Doesn't say I'm the wrong defendant. This trial court had only that affidavit before it when it reviewed that motion for new trial. In our view, we should at least require parties to come forward and show the trial court what it is they're complaining about. And when they came in with the motion for new trial, all they had was the affidavit that says, I didn't know anything about the facts of this case and I didn't file an answer. Many times I suggest that registered agents or corporations in this state are not going to know anything about the facts of the case. That's why they turn these citations over to their lawyers to determine whether or not an answer was necessary. That did not happen here. Under the view taken by petitioners, a party ought to be able to say, and he said it, say we're the wrong defendant, that automatically that abolishes the other two prongs. When the fact is, we believe that the policy of this state should be that a party complaining of a judgment should come forward and address the trial court with reasons why that there ought to be a new trial entered. They had plenty of opportunities to do that. Our position is that Craddock is working. This court has not been faced with the revisitations of Craddock, has not been faced with guiding the courts of appeals and guiding our trial courts on Craddock. Essentially, it's predictable for the bench and the bar. It's working in this state. Now, in applying these principles, we think there ought to be, as Craddock suggests, a policy in favor of someone not ignoring citations that are served upon them, even as Justice Hector suggested, in some cases by mistake or against the wrong party. Ignore a citation, one must pay the consequences. In the case of an honest mistake, a new trial should be granted. Because the petitioner's predicament is solely of its own doing, we believe that the Court of Appeals ought to be affirmed.
Why wasn't this an honest mistake?
Why wasn't it an honest mistake?
Yeah, you said if it was an honest mistake, a new trial should be granted.
Because the affidavit just doesn't reflect that. When Judge Kilgore had the record before him, there was no evidence whatsoever that he ever had the opportunity to review this complaint, despite the at least 75 days the petitioner had to show Judge Kilgore that it was, in fact, an honest mistake.
Well, the affidavit of the registered agent, which apparently is, I don't know whether he was more than just a registered agent and active in the business or not, but the affidavit itself reports or says that Holt Atkin Industries, Inc. has never done business with Roy, Inc. or Kitty Heine, nor repaired any type of equipment, nor provided any type of service of any kind, either Roy or Kitty Heine. So it does state, at least the affiant's belief, that you got the wrong guy.
Under our reading of Ivy versus Carroll, that would not be enough. But even if it was enough to suggest that it was a meritorious defense, it has nothing to do with the prong of the test that requires the petitioner in this case to show Judge Kilgore in this case why it was they didn't file an answer other than the fact that they thought they weren't liable. Justice Gonzales.
Well, you have a sliding scale about how stupid somebody is. In other words, I'm not being facetious because there's some evidence of that in the case. But if you think that if you're not in business and you get a complaint that you don't have to file an answer, then that may show credit. But if you're a more sophisticated business person and understands the courts, then the trial court can make a judgment that that is conscious indifference. Is that what you're saying?
I think and that's the way what we're saying, and that's the way it has worked successfully over the past 16 years.
The trial judge made a
made a determination that this person should have known and was therefore consciously indifferent?
Well, the affidavit purports to know a little bit about business in that as Justice Cornyn suggested, that we didn't do business with this person and we're not actively involved in repairing bulldozers. So it ostensibly shows some knowledge. But I think we get to a point where, are we going to have a policy in this state that suggests that a person who gets a citation that says you have been sued and if you don't answer, a default judgment may be entered against you, whether we're going to have a policy that supports a person taking that citation and saying, I don't know anything about it, I'm going to throw it in the trash can. Because I don't think that would be good, sound public policy of this state to encourage people who don't believe they're liable to throw those citations in the trash can without investigating and without consulting a lawyer.
After the defendants filed their initial answer, weren't you put on notice that they have the wrong defendant and been very easy to fix?
Which wrong defendant, Judge Gonzalez?
Well, they tell you, we are not in the business of repairing dozers. We're not liable in the capacity in which we were sued.
That's not petitioner, Your Honor. Petitioner never said that. Petitioner never said that until it got to the Court of Appeals. Then petitioner came forward and made that statement. Those answers were filed by other defendants, not this petitioner. This petitioner filed no responsive pleadings until the motion for new trial was filed, which had the affidavit of Mr. Stevenson Atherton attached to it. That's the only notice the trial court got that this defendant was, quote, the wrong defendant.
Were all these different corporate entities represented by the same lawyer?
Well, as Mr. Caldwell suggested, he represents four out of the six of them now. However, in this case, earlier on, the record doesn't show who was represented by whom back in the early stages. Certainly, this defendant, by their supplemental record, if it is to be accepted, shows that these corporations are all related in some way. But whether or not they were all represented by the same counsel back then is a different question. Certainly, the petitioner was not represented until it filed a motion for a new trial. And allowed, of course, these other Holt entities allowed the severance to take place without objection.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
Any
other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Caldwell will present the little argument for petition.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I think, have focused on the basic problem with this case. It's a default judgment against the wrong defendant based on damages testimony, which we later learned to be false. But of the points that I argued originally, all three of those points are based on the original record. And this court could, based on the original record...
Original record for the trial court?
Yes, sir. Based on the original record, by applying Craddock properly, by applying Dow versus Winters from this court, could... reverse this default judgment.
Counsel, would you speak to the initial request to dismiss this petition for lack of jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor. The motion for rehearing that was filed in the Court of Appeals, I filed a prefatory two-page motion for rehearing and filed concurrently with that a brief that set out the arguments and the points of error. The motion for rehearing that I filed that does raise the points that argued here today specifically states that it's incorporating the concurrently filed brief by reference and that the points of error relied on are set forth in there. And they have raised a hyper-technical argument that the language of the rule says the points should be specified in the motion for rehearing. I would submit that the brief that was filed along with that motion for rehearing is certainly sufficient to apprise the Court of Appeals the points of error that are being relied on for the rehearing.
Do we need to overrule oil field haulers to assume jurisdiction over this case?
No, Your Honor, because the points that have been argued here today were specifically raised in the brief. Oilfield Haulers deals with a motion for rehearing that says, generically, we raise all points raised before, essentially. So this case is certainly distinguishable where you have the brief.
Your brief is filed a week later. I mean, where would you draw the line?
I would say it has to be filed at the same time, Judge. The other point is that I think that the Heineys were trying to argue that somehow there's a difference between Mr. Atherton's affidavit where he said, gave the facts as to why they did not answer, and trying to draw some distinction between that and a mistaken legal belief. Well, I think that Mr. Atherton's affidavit does set forth the facts that show a mistaken legal belief very clearly. And in fact, if all we did was go back and add a sentence to that affidavit that says, for these reasons I did not file an answer because of a mistaken legal belief, that's a conclusory statement that the Court of Appeals attacked in its opinion. It doesn't add anything. The thing to look to is the facts, and the facts, I think, clearly set forth a mistaken legal belief.
Would you leave your chair?
Yes, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the third cause. The foregoing causes are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments. It concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.